study this morning is John chapter 13, verse 1. We'll read four verses, Sister Esther.
Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. And supper being ended, the devil, having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he was come from God and went to God, he riseth from supper, and laid aside his garment, and took a towel, and girded himself.
All right. Verse 1. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when was the feast of the Passover? In reference to Nisan.
Before they were saved.
All right. And when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father. From this time setting here, how long was it before he died? Roughly.
It was 3 o'clock the next afternoon.
All right. Next afternoon. In other words, it's less than one day. So when it says before the feast of the Passover, that would mean that this is the day before the Passover. But Hebrew reckoning, not our reckoning. No, it's the 14th. Yes, that's the day before. The Passover is the 15th. He dies the 14th, and this is still the 14th because he's eating an evening meal, and the Hebrew day begins at 6 o'clock or sunset. So we get a time reference or setting. This is, in other words, he knows that he's going to be crucified within 24 hours. This is the setting. Knowing that his hour has come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. Unto the end of what? Verse 2. And supper being ended, the devil, having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. What's this about supper being ended?
The guys lot in certain parts seem to indicate suffering as being prepared, being served, rather than having completely ended.
Yes, the Diaglot has that, the Revised Standard. There are a number of versions. In other words, this is incorrect in the King James, and supper being ended. It hadn't ended. And so these other translations translated. That the supper having been served. But now the thing is, had they started to eat or not started to eat? You know, you can have it prepared. So different translations make a fine distinction in that certainly the supper was not ended. But some have it that it's in process of being eaten, and this happens. And some have it that it has just been set. It's like the food has just been brought. Incidentally, what was the supper consist of? All right, it was a lamb, roast lamb, and, plus other things, the unleavened bread and so forth. And why does it put this here about the devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him? In why is that insertion made here?
Because up to this point, Judas still couldn't change his mind. But now would be an accomplished fact that he was going ahead with his early thinking and visiting with the priest and making the plan.
Yes.
I read a lovely article. I don't know how it would bear out with this. But the idea was that having supper been put on the table and possibly having partaken, Jesus was thinking as to why no one offered to wash the feet, which was the custom, before they would eat. And none of the, and he knew that in the minds of the others, no one wanted this meal.
Yeah, but that wasn't the question.
No, I know. But what I'm leading up to is this, that this attitude that Jesus took and girded himself to do this menial job, is though Judas now, having this money idea in his head as well, to get money for Jesus, also probably looked down at Jesus with more scorn than would naturally have been otherwise, that this might have instigated it sort of, Jesus, the lowly attitude in doing this sort of thing.
Well, the pastor does suggest that in an article that Wendy does that later, which we haven't come to, Judas looked down probably with scorn at what Jesus had done because he's not in the right heart attitude to start with. That's one view. Anybody else any suggestions? Notice that there are certain different problems on Jesus' mind. One is he's going to die. Now he knows he's right down, the hour is fast approaching. Now, normally people would be concerned with themselves, with their own fate, and would like, let's say, I'd like to go in seclusion. I'd like to pray or withdraw themselves or not take this time because of their concern of how they're going to handle the thing, the situation, when it arises, when he is betrayed in the garden. That's one condition. The nearness of approach of his own death and the crucifixion is a terrible thing to look forward to. And secondly, there was a betrayer at the table with him. So, being of a sensitive nature, to know that one around the table who was to partake of that Passover meal with him, let alone the memorial later, that was a concern. If a person is sensitive about the welfare of each individual and knowing that there was this betrayer in his midst, that would be a concern. So here he has two problems in this that would like seem to be like a psychological problem that he is being confronted with. But in spite of these two things, he was more concerned to give advice and counsel to his disciples. Having loved them, he loved them unto the end, and even manifested this love to Judas to a certain extent, which we haven't come to yet, which we will discuss later. So I would suggest that this is inserted here to show the burden on his mind, and that this was a real burden, that can be easily shown, but we're not going to take that time. That he was troubled by this Judas there is easily proven. We're not even going to attempt it. You can do that on your own. But that is a problem, plus his own fate of being crucified next afternoon. He would know even the hour. while Judas, Satan put it into the heart of Judas to betray the master, technically it had not yet been done. Otherwise, this, to show his love to Judas would be a contradiction of principle. No, Judas had intended to do it. He had made arrangements, but he had not yet done it. So there's a difference between a sin and sinning a sin. A sin in the mind is one thing, but a sin that results in an act is a sinning a sin. And that's very important in this particular chapter, because we would then, many have drawn wrong conclusions on this chapter, certain things which we'll discuss a little later. Third verse, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he was come from God and went to God, he riseth from supper. Any comments on this?
This went to, was going to, I think, more correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Notice, he realizes now that it is, as it were, that the fate of the world was like, as it were, in his hands, knowing that the Father had committed to him all things. Now he feels the responsibility for what he is about to do from now until he finishes his course. And now, having these thoughts in mind of his, that the Father's trust and confidence in him is such that he knows that Jesus is intending to fulfill his Father's purposes, and that as a reward he would be raised and eventually go back to the Father. He riseth from supper. It's with this frame of mind that, in spite of all these things in his mind, the nearness of his execution, the betrayal of Judas at the table, the responsibility of what he's going to do, that now it's almost like the whole world is like an atlas, is on his shoulders as to what he is about to do. Nevertheless, he possesses a calmness of mind to realize the importance of instructing his disciples in a certain lesson, of which they had failed, as has been mentioned, to perform. He riseth from supper to wash their feet, the disciples' feet. Now, this would seem to suggest to me, I'm just giving my own opinion, that the meal was on the table, as it were, but they hadn't eaten. And that he waited psychologically to the very last moment, because this washing of the feet should have taken place before the supper. But he waits till it's on the table, that then, it's at that decisive moment, gets up. Now, put yourself there. Here everything served. Master is the chief one. And then he stands up, and he says, walks aside, and he begins to change his apparel the way it's on him, takes a towel, removes around his waist. Perhaps he took his coat off in doing this. And they're watching in amazement as to his behavior. Everything's here, set. So he did, Jesus did many, many, many things under a startling backdrop, even today's manna. It says, O ye of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt? But there was a storm raging. The waves were coming in the boat. You'd think, my goodness, we should do something to wake him up care us thou not that we perish? But he says, in that situation, which would seem to be a proper thing, and who in the world would ever dream of having faith, normally speaking? But he chose that moment to make this incisive remark, O ye of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt? Well, we know we would doubt under that circumstance. If we were in that boat, like they were, but he chose that situation to give a very penetrating lesson. So this here is psychologically the same thing. Oh, he's done this so many times that at this moment, when they're ready to partake, he now gets up and he starts to change and prepare himself. And then you imagine getting the water, pouring the water. All this takes time. You know, we read it, he just gets up and he starts washing. No, he has to go around and they're watching him and he's behaving like a servant. And then he comes around to them to wash their feet in amazement. And you'll notice they were all evidently still in the reclining position. They're so amazed. Instead of getting up, they're there with their feet stretched out, and he starts now to go around and to wash their feet. And Brother Russell draws some very helpful lessons on this. Yes? Anything?
It was, because he was observing mentally who was going to do this test, that they never did it without washing first. And no one, everyone wanted to be first. No one seemed to want to take the lower position. And previous to that, wasn't it true that had said they wanted to be on his right hand and on the left or something to that effect?
When they were down approaching from Jericho to Jerusalem, walking up to Jerusalem, they took him aside, yes, and asked if they could be. James and John requested that they could sit on the right and left hand. So they were desirous of chief position, these two. Yes?
There has been a chronology here. You say the supper was still on the table, but the foot washing preceded the eating of the meal and preceded the emblem. Because it'll say later in the chapter that Jesus gives thought to Jesus. Then, or do we assume that Jesus?
I have to go into that step by step rather than answer that question, which goes through the whole thing. We're saying that this, yes. Yes. Yeah, well. All right, well, in the Matthew, we agreed with.
But Judas was present for the foot washing and also to partake of the bread and the wine emblems. In fact, the foot washing took place after the partaking of the emblems. Order, bread, cup, foot washing. So that's where the supper was surely to see the bread and the cup.
Yes, well, there's only one point there is different, and that is with regard to the Matthew account and to the John account, or Luke's account, too. There's no contradiction there except on the one point. No? Read that again. We'll call attention.
Judas was present for the foot washing. And
all right, that's safe.
And also to partake of the bread and the wine. And
that's true. No difference there.
In fact, the foot washing took place after the partaking of the emblem. Order, bread, cup, foot washing.
Well, I may be wrong on that, see, because that's what I'm saying. John is correcting that thought.
in that article that I read, the main meal, which was the Passover, had been the placing of, but not the memorial part. That was what preceded. Jesus serving them before, as I understood.
Well, we're coming to that as we're going along. We're just starting here. That we're trying to say that before they partake, there is this ceremony, and it would be most logical that the washing takes place before the meal. I mean, that's the whole Jewish tradition. So I may have made a mistake in the Matthew study. Incidentally, these studies are a lot different than when you write on the subject, where you do all the comparing. You know, this is extemporaneous, much of this. When we have a study like this, and we're going verse by verse, I'm open, I follow the line of reasoning in some cases. In some cases, myself, don't make the technically, maybe exactly the correct analysis. Incidentally, I don't think many people even bother to discuss this in the fashion we're doing with such technical approach in these studies. Now, in this account, he's going to wash their feet, taking a towel and probably wrapping it around his stomach. It probably was a very long towel. And he uses the long towel like a girdle. Puts it around his waist, and then it like an apron, it's falling down, but it's held up in his lower part of the torso. So he's going around with this towel, which is attached to him, and it also puts his garments tidy so that he won't be tripping over himself when he does this washing. Bobby pulled his garments up, anything long, and used the towel as a girdle, as it were, and now he's going to wash and dry their feet. Now the thing is, the apostles themselves, none of them had the humility to. They might have even thought of this thought about not having the feet not being washed. They might have just been silent on that. We don't know. But none of them proffered to do that. So showing then that they lacked the humility to perform that what would be conceived of as a menial act. And incidentally, this is completely contrary to tradition. To do a menial act like that, a superior person, particularly the one who is the chief guest of honor, to do that, why, that is absolutely unbelievable. It's not right. I mean, in their thinking. It's not. So he's doing this. Now, all this took time, and you can imagine their thoughts at this time, watching him do that. And he's going around and washing now their feet. Let's read verse 6.
Okay.
Yes.
Question on verse 3.
Yeah.
Which talks about the knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands. Was this thinking about that Jesus, the responsibility that he had felt for the disciples and taking care of them, would that be included as part of those?
Yeah, problems? Oh yeah, that's what I meant there. That in spite of these other problems that pertain to his own emotions, and again, that in spite of all these things, knowing that what was going to happen, and the present condition of Judas being there, that he loved them at that moment, during the meal, after the emblems, during his discourses, on the way to the Garden of Gethsemane, all the way until he was finally apprehended. And of course, he couldn't manifest too much love until certain incidents occurred, like on the cross, where to John and to his mother, Mary, that's at the end. But there's a gap there that he wasn't permitted because he's on trial. But in spite of all these things, he has this concern, and now he wants to give advice to the disciples. Now, it's interesting. The other three Gospels don't contain this advice. Here you have a whole sermon, chapter after chapter of instruction that is omitted in the other Gospels. Maybe a phrase, a little piece here, a little piece, but nothing like this. And John was very much struck with that account. In fact, the memorial night had a very deep, scarring effect upon John, so that he even used "my little children." He began to use that type of language as he began to be an older man. He began to feel, and he says, a commandment that I give you, that you should love. He's thinking of the memorial season. That left a tremendous mark on, so much so that now we're at chapter 13, and you go to here, what is it, 21, chapter 21, about nine chapters of it, is only on this last day, on one day, that this is like, as it were, generally speaking. Now you go to the other Gospels, and the percentage of the Gospel that's recorded is far, far less than that. It's very brief. You go to them, it's one or two chapters. And it sort of races through. But he takes the trouble here to insert several chapters of instruction that Jesus gave his disciples. So it's with this background that he does this. And not only does he think, is he concerned for his apostles and disciples, but he sees a lack, a certain lack, and now he's going to demonstrate their need for instruction in humility. And he takes it and does it in this startling way. Let's read 6 through 10. Or 11, 6 through 11. Next, please.
Then cometh he to Simon Peter, and Peter saith unto him, Lord, dost thou wash my feet? Jesus answered and said unto him, What I do thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter. Peter saith unto him, Thou shalt never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. Simon Peter saith unto him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Jesus saith unto him, He that is washed needeth not save to wash his feet, but is clean every whit, and ye are clean, but not all. For he knew who should betray him. Therefore said he, Ye are not all clean.
Now, this is the Berean Manual, which most of you have, and which has some interesting comments. He says, unto the end, supper being ended, Brother Russell says, being served, ready for the meal to begin. I'm reading, you know, the verse by verse explanation. And then he says, the devil, whose very existence is now denied by many. That isn't the point. The disciples' feet, the open sandals worn in biblical times, made the washing of the feet after a journey a necessity for personal comfort. The apostles at this time were insufficiently filled with humility, love, and thoughtfulness to volunteer this service for each other, or even for the master. I think this is so much in this. And thus missed a great blessing. Now, then it comes to verse 8, which has just been read. It's hard for some to realize that the Lord is the teacher, and they are merely pupils. That's the comment. Thou shalt never wash my feet. And then he also says later, well, don't just wash my feet, wash my head also. So this is, that is wash, bathe. All the disciples had previously been in accordance with the Jewish requirements at the beginning of the Passover season. That is, they had been clean in other respects because they were going to have the memorial. But this personal attention of the feet, that hadn't been done. But not all. As it was God's goodness and mercy that hardened Pharaoh's heart, so it was the love and the humility of Jesus that hardened Judas's heart. That's what you were bringing out earlier. That act of humility hardened Judas. That's about it. Up there, but there were certain things there I thought were just better to read it. Now, coming back to
in this cleaning washing, it was customary that they would go to a public bath and take baths before the temple. Is that something to that?
Yes, I would. It would be logical, even though when you read back in the law that it tells about the cleaning of the house and seeing that all unleavened bread, that leavened bread, all leavened bread would be put out, they would draw from that lesson that this is a period of where purity is necessary. And so they would just draw the natural lesson that they would make sure that they were clean and clothed properly for the occasion. So therefore, they had been prepared in that reason. But this other little additional act of even when they're going to this house to observe the memorial, and like he's saying, with sandals, open feet, toes, sandals, that there would be some defilement even in the short distance they might take to go to that supper. And that therefore it was customary for the servant to wash the feet of the guests. Such circumstances. Even the hands, too. But here, Jesus showing, is impressing the lesson of the feet in contact with the earth. All right, now, verse 8. Peter saith unto him, thou shalt never wash my feet. Then Jesus answered him, if I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. Jesus' words and all are very startling. The thing, not only his deeds, acts, but this is rather incisive remark. It's like a quick remark. If, for instance, if I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. I mean, that's strong. Oh, well, now people, oh, no, not that. No, see, that he hadn't thought of it in that light. But Peter had just said, now it says here, thou shalt never wash my feet. It's even stronger in the word for word, where it's more emphatic. It's like, never shalt thou wash my feet. That's a little stronger, you see. You know, it's in a more of a dogmatic frame of utterance. But then he says in the verse 9, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. And when we read this comment of Brother Russell, see that it includes this whole thought. Some are continually trying to be wise, good, and obedient in ways that the Lord has not dictated. He is trying to be good, Peter, in this. Wash my feet. No. Well, wash my feet, but my hands and my head also. This is extracurricular addendum that he's putting in here, and that sometimes Brother Russell draws a lesson that sometimes we manufacture good deeds along certain lines that the Lord's Word does not instruct. In other words, we put in things. We should be the pupil rather than the teacher. These are hard lessons, and of course, fortunately, Peter is voicing what no doubt others would feel. It's just his temperament to be outspoken, and no doubt this would be very helpful to all of them who would have similar, probably, thoughts, many of them. He that is washed needeth not save to wash his feet, but is clean every whit, and ye are clean, but not all. And of course, you're quite familiar as to "but not all" that refers to Jews. And that's helpful to know in the sense that Jesus was not taken by surprise. He was not taken by surprise. He knew all along the circumstances that were occurring. And for he knew who should betray him, therefore said he, "Ye are not all clean." Now, this would end this particular thing. Now he would then take the towel off, resume his position at the table, and now things are ready to proceed. After having given that lesson, a lot of other things probably are happening too, because of the that are referred to, let us say, in some of the other Gospels. It said that at this time they were debating amongst themselves who should be greatest in the kingdom. Now, as has been suggested earlier, that this began like in Jericho, when the two asked to sit on Jesus' right hand and left hand, but the other apostles, it tells us, were mad that these two had the nerve to make this request to Jesus when they heard about it, and no doubt thought that maybe they should be on that hand, or that they had a nerve just to ask. So they're disputing. And this troublesome condition was not just something that was just brushed aside. They got over it. Evidently, it followed them. So Jesus is coming into the city, and notice all the things that happened, the cleansing of the temple, the fig tree cursed, and the washing of his, the anointing of his body by Mary, and a whole lot of things happened. And now we're at the memorial, and this thing is still with them. This contention or desire to be greatest. Not greater than Jesus, but greater as far as among themselves as to who should be. So this is a condition that's interesting to observe, human behavior. And Jesus knew that all along. And so he's tried to squelch that attitude. And no doubt even when the meal is being prepared, they might have had some discussion while they're there at the table as to who should be greatest. And so then then Jesus gets up and starts to wash the feet of the disciples in that frame of mind, when it would have best effect. By waiting, and this other condition surfacing, and then doing this act of humility. Yes?
In that article where it said how he washed with the water, and that they did not soak it in a basin, he poured fresh water, and I was thinking how appropriate that we don't wash with the muddy water of others, but we get our fresh supply from the Master with each washing. It's poured upon the foot. And I was thinking from another standpoint that it would be, you know, like instead of putting your foot in the same basin and washing, which could be done, but it wouldn't be pure no more.
It's while it was a literal washing, being it was figurative and what it was meant to demonstrate, that would have to be done in this other fashion, that the water not be sullied from one to the next. Now, he gets up and he goes to the table, as it were, and now he says, we got to read this, verse 12 through 17.
If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, neither he that is sent greater than he that sent him.
Oh, one more. Did I say something?
If ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them.
All right. So then, after he reassembles himself, sits down at the table, or is in a reclining position, and he's in the position that he was before he arises and washes their feet, that no doubt this is the first remarks he made. Otherwise, they'd be lost. You see what I mean? If he started to eat supper, this begins to fade, what he just did. It becomes dim. But they're all shocked at what he's done, and this is very strange. This is very strange what happened. And now he sits down, and no doubt they wonder, what's he going to do next? I mean, with such happenings, you don't know what the master's going to do, because he seizes on these opportunities. So now he says, know ye what I have done to you? And this is he's picking up the threads that of thought that no doubt went through them. And didn't he say to Peter, you don't know what I'm doing now, but you shall know. So some feel that the explanation of it, part of it at least, immediately occurred. Part of it. Because now he's saying, know ye not what I have done to you. Ye call me Master and Lord, and ye say well, for so I am. Jesus has a stark frankness in his expressions. Says that's proper. Not false humility. There's a time not to be, as it were, assume a humble posture. There are occasions where it might diminish the proper respect for the message that is to be given. Like Paul would say occasionally, I am an apostle of the Lord. I speak to you thus. Not just speaking to you as a fellow brother. He sometimes does that approach, but sometimes with very important instruction. When something's very important, it's like saying that this has to be prefaced in the right setting. Then, if your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. Now, of course, there were some who felt that once a year this should be done. The Armstrong movement is one. And the Pope does it, too, occasionally. But then he also wants them to kiss his toe when they're made cardinals. There are times he goes to this church outside the Vatican. I think there's a certain church, St. John's. One of those churches, not the Vatican itself. And he washes the feet of, what is it, six or seven men that are picked up off the street. You can be sure. You can be sure that they had been previously. But they are selective candidates. And then he ceremonially, now you see, he's assuming the posture in this way of the Lord, which is not right. It's like they're even being carried about like the Ark of the Covenant. These are things that are foreign. So this washing of the feet, of course, is figurative. It shows the concern that we should have one another lest we fall into temptation and perish or stray from the path. And that this should be a mutual concern on our part. For one another. For I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you. Now, this example that Jesus did there was done physically and literally, wasn't it? I mean, you would get the thought at first that what he is saying, that I just washed your feet literally. Therefore, ye should wash literally the feet one of another. But that isn't quite the thought. It is that that demonstration is pointedly bringing to the surface an attitude that where one should be forgiving of one another their trespasses and sins in the way that Jesus did. See? That's the key part. Now, for I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you. Now, not merely what he did to them that night, but what he did to them through his whole ministry, starting from beginning to end. And there are many things that he did. For instance, he took them aside. Unto you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them that are without, it is not given. And then the way he spoke to them, he did not, when it was proper to rebuke his disciples for wrong conduct, he did it. But of course, being Lord, he could do it in a manner more officiously than we as the Lord's disciples can do one to another. But if we can say, thus saith the Lord, as to what should be done, then that would be proper, because the Lord's word tells you what to do under certain conditions. And if you do that and follow that admonition and also give that admonition to others because it tells you in the Bible to do that, well, then it's not you, really. It's the Lord's instruction what to do. So he says, ye should love one another as I have loved you. We have to review his whole life. Therefore, it's important to be thoroughly familiar with our Lord's ministry. And I had an experience many years ago when I was at a table. We had had a meal, and the one who was the chief one at that particular gathering, the comment came to the surface at the table about the need of being familiar with the gospel and the New Testament. And it was squelched right there. It said, all these others have been studying all their lives the gospel. What do they know? They're referring to the nominal church. Giving this as an excuse, well, look what they have done and what has it been to them. And then and this was by the chief one at the table, or whom everybody looked up to, and I was horrified at that type of advice. And this, however, is the attitude of many others, not just the one at that occasion, which I found out through the years. So we have to be careful that we're not conditioned by other people to do things that are not in harmony with the Lord's word. For certainly, I don't think we can study our Lord's life too much. I can't see that. I think if you study his words, his comments, his deeds, it's like saying you can't be too consecrated. Even that comment was made on another occasion where somebody was criticized because they were too consecrated. They were too serious, too involved in trying to do the Lord's will. So this loving one another is to as Jesus loved his disciples. And then when we look at his life and study his life, we can see that it was done in accordance with principles, not just an emotional outpouring of sympathy, because sometimes sympathy is wrong. Sympathy can encourage wrongdoing. But sympathy can be very helpful can be very wonderful balsam or oil poured on the wound when the person is in the proper attitude to respond favorably to the situation. Not favorably to you, but favorable to the Lord's instruction. So this then example is that of this humility, that you should, I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you. Now notice, here he brings the Father in again. Isn't this amazing? In John's Gospel, he always brings in the Father being greater. In one way or another, in most of all these conversations we have, if you take them out and sort them, he, when he refers to himself, he either, before he refers to himself, tells the status of the Father first, or after he has made strong statements about himself, he'll make a reference to the Father as being above all. And here he does again. I think it's 6 or 7 times in this study of John already where we've seen this characteristic behavior that Jesus had of deference always to his Father, and thus we should have the same respect for Jesus' office and instruction to us. Then it says, if ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them. So this is hard. This is a hard lesson because you can have the head knowledge and yet not the follow through. It's as though he has thought these things out so carefully. It's almost like a prepared lesson. Yet Jesus was prepared before he sat down at that table because it was in him. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many. So this is just a part of him, so that he was so immersed into the thinking of God, the principles of God, what he knows that the Father would appreciate, that he could, like on any occasion, know just what to say, and when you read it, it's profound. All the little adjectives, he puts in little adjectives in, or little comments. If ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them. It's as though his thoughts are well rounded out. Even on these, what would you would consider as haphand circumstances of him just sitting down at that particular place, at that particular serving with his apostles. Any observations or comments before we can conclude? We just would have one other comment. Later. We think that after having made these remarks, then he ate. He ate the meal. The memorial that hasn't taken place yet. He begins to eat. Now, to show you, we would proffer some advice. There are people in the making of this Bible, this study like the King James Bible, this has come down through centuries of time, with a lot of people thinking on some of these thoughts. So you'll notice that they have a break here. Look at the next verse. See that break? See that P that's backwards? That shows that the ones who were translating the Bible realizes that the next verse did not immediately happen, where it says, I speak not of you all, I know whom I have chosen. They say that something else is to be inserted in there. One of the things is they're eating the meal. He waits. Now, when you're eating the meal, you cannot give deep instruction. You're eating lamb and so forth, and you're having, drinking maybe the wine or whatever it might be, as the custom was at the Passover feast, that they're eating this in advance. They're observing the Passover one day in advance. So they're having this lamb dinner meal, which none of the gospel writers mention. None of the four gospels say that he ate lamb. But that is implied. And therefore, the translators put here a break. So we should not despise the markings in the Bible, but they're not a good, they're not a thoroughly reliable breaking down of the accounts. When you read the Bible this way, they're not always reliable, the breaks, because they're the product of many cases sanctified thought given to the context, and they put them in as meaning to be helpful. So these marks that are put in the Bible are marks that are put there by others who are trying to help other students in later generations to appreciate, stop here, that there's a break. There's a break here. And the break, we believe, was the meal. And then, after they had eaten the meal, then he's ready to talk about some other things. Because how can you pass me the so-and-so, or could have, and they're reaching over to get things, how can you get the attention of 12 people, get their unriveted attention, when you're doing all these other things? You can't. So that break, we should, like, realize the situation. Now, when the supper is coming, drawing to a close, the main meal, then he resumes the serious conversation. As they're getting near the end of the meal, not after everything's done, but near the end of the meal, when everybody now has had their portion and done, and so forth, then he begins to talk again seriously to them. So with these thoughts in mind, it's helpful. You get a backdrop of the situation that occurred there and how the master's technique in addressing his disciples with these important truths. And, of course, we can see Judas is here by the next verse. He's still at the table, which would be in harmony, too, with the other Gospels. I think we'll have to close here, except that if somebody would like to make a comment, please do so, else we'll close.
Frank, and as you said earlier, Pope, he gets the foot get kissed instead of foot washing only. That shouldn't be there. That also shows that he's the Antichrist. Mm. It's not contrast to the Jesus teaching.
Yes, because it says in the Old Testament, kiss the Son, lest he be angry. So they use this context even in Latin. And they're quoting this when this ceremony takes place. They read it, and they're giving the Son there is Jesus. And so when they kiss the Pope, but his toe, that's their act of subjection and humility to him as Christ, where he is, as you are inferring, he's verily Antichrist. He's the false or counterfeit Christ. Let us then conclude this particular service.